they interviewed more than 6,000 American parents and their children. The children were ages 8 to 13. And they wanted to identify both the perception and the realities of the parents' use of technology devices, but also the opinion of the children. And it's important to know that about one third of the children said that their parents spent equal or less time with them than in using their devices. Over half of the children felt that their parents checked their devices too often and complained that their parents allowed themselves to be distracted by their devices during conversation, something that made a third of them feel unimportant. It must be said that many parents, too, when asked about their devices' usage, agreed that it was too frequent. And many parents also worried about how this looked to the young generation. I conclude by saying that almost a third felt that they did not set a good example for their children with their internet devices.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. And my two guests today are Drs. Franco Dalberton and Andrea Scardovi. And our conversation today focuses on a paper they've written in the Psychoanalytic Study of the Child in 2021. The paper is entitled, Children Exposed to Pornographic Images on the Internet, General and Specific Aspects in a Psychoanalytic Perspective. And our focus in this conversation is not simply on the effects of the overstimulation of pornography in the developing mind of the child, but their point is that it is more the absence of a meaningfully present adult with whom to process these experiences that forms the core of the trauma. We'll spend a great deal of time on that. Let me just make some introductions for us. Dr. Dalberton is a psychologist and child and adolescent psychoanalyst, a full member and training analyst of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society. He worked in the NHS service, first as a psychologist in the field of child mental health, and then as a consultant in psychology at the pediatric department of S. Orsola University Hospital in Bologna. His work initially aimed at adults, training in clinical psychology and psychotherapy, and he is now increasingly turned to working with children, adolescents, and family problems, and he is currently in private practice. Dr. Andrea Scardovi is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst and a full member of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society. He worked also in NHS services and at Bologna University, where he has for many years taught courses on communicative elements of psychotherapy. He developed a training method to improve interview skills of general practitioners, which was adopted at various Italian regions. He's been a member of the editorial board of the Italian Journal of Psychoanalysis, and he is currently working in private practice. I hope you find their contribution to be as meaningful as I have. I think their emphasis on the importance of caretakers in the lives of children who not only are available to process it, but also, as they make clear, are available to set guidelines and rules and limitations. And they discuss the various kinds of rules and limitations that parents can set for children that is useful for all concerned. Here is my conversation. Andrea and Franco, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you both here. Our topic of conversation on pornography is one that I've had before on episode 103 back in February 22. I had a conversation with Claudio Spadazzi from Rome and Jose Zussman from Rio de Janeiro. And our conversation was about the role of addictive pornography in adults. Now, that's a different situation than what we're going to speak of today. But to summarize, what was really a rich conversation, and the link to that episode will be in these show notes. Jose Zussman characterize it as follows. He says, with adult addictive pornography, there is an intolerance for what he called mature dependency. And in the face of that intolerance, there is a turn to impoverished, desolate, and concrete internal scenarios. Now, your work with children and adolescents doesn't obviously involve mature dependency. It involves, as we're about to learn, the presence of mature caregivers with whom the individual child can learn mature dependency. And that, your work finds, is key to distinguish a healthy adaptation from a problematic adaptation. So let me start us off by reading a few sections from your paper and invite you to comment. Franco, let's start with you, and let me read this following. You write, pornography on the internet can impact the child by easily and forcefully engaging his mind, imposing sexual images onto an evolving subjectivity that is engaged in defining its own sexual fantasies and informing its own internal world. Franco, tell us about that.
Thank you, Harry, for this question, and thank you for inviting us to this podcast. You know, as a child psychoanalyst, we know the importance of sexuality on child's development. And, you know, mature dependency is a goal, is something that is going to happen in the becoming of the childhood. And sexuality has a big importance on that. And we have learned that boys and girls develop their desire to know, starting from their curiosity about origins, about the difference between the sexes, all around the Oedipal dynamics. Pregnancies, births of siblings, observation of the difference in the sexes are all occasions that question the mind of children, to which their research and their sexual theories try to give an answer. How are babies born? Why are males and females different? These are questions that push the little explorer, we say, as Freud called little Hans, to seek answers and meaning in what questions their young minds. We can say that the human body, one's own or that of the others, arouses great interest in different stages of children's lives. And it's important to know that the way in which these interests are articulated within parent-child relationships also affect the relationship that, in turn, the boy or girl will have with their own body. To the extent that the child feels that the messages that adult sexuality convey through caring relationships, those are messages that LaPlanche defined as enigmatic. These messages can be translated into thoughts and representation, and if they can go through that, it is the entire world of the knowledge that opens itself to the child as a world that can be discovered and which authorizes his or her curiosity and ownership to ask questions and to seek answers.
Now, what you're referring to early on, then, is the development in the child is based upon the quality of the interaction and, if you will, the maturity of the adult caretaker. That's what you're. That's the thesis of the research that you've done.
Yes, of course. That it is, yes, because if the boy or the girl are allowed to put questions, it doesn't matter the exact answer they have, but it's important that they are allowed to put questions and to have answers that can be applied to their ages, because It's the longing for what is absent or enigmatic that can help to develop the capacity of thinking. And it's what paves the way to symbolization and representation.
Now, Andrea, do you have anything you want to add to that? Because I have my next quote is about this very issue, about the particulars of childhood development and how central is the active presence of the adult. Is there anything you want to add before I read my next quote that I pulled up?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Harvey. And thanks also by me for this invitation so kind. The point to which Franco was just hinting now, and that you introduced with your last questions, that of the answer of the adult, has an important origin for us as psychoanalysts. Because, as Franco said, we try to highlight the implication of the current exposure of children and adolescents to the pervasive quantity of images on the net, no? And the impact on this fact on the subject's psychic work and internal processes and so on. And to examine this phenomena, the last questions you asked Franco about the importance of the answer of the adults, it's a very psychoanalytic one, we could say, because maybe paradoxically, but we have found something very interesting and specific to understand this situation about addictions and and the exposure of children to pornographic images on the internet in Sam Freud's early concept. And one of these is the so-said concept of specific action, which is what happens, for example, when a child cries and the attendant adult responds with attention and help. So something very simple, no? That is important also for the common sense, not just for psychoanalysts. But Freud also says that for the development of the child's fledgling self, it's essential for him to feel that he has aroused a perceivable reaction in his object and in the adult, an internal change that attests that a real contact between him and the adult has occurred. And we find it relevant, this, for understanding the problem of overexposition to children, to images, because Freud also clears here that it's only after having achieved a specific effect on the adult that it becomes possible for the child to achieve an experience of satisfaction, something that allows the birth of representation and is a basis of the possibility to make thinkable even what appears more enigmatic or incomprehensible.
I was interested in your reference to specific action in your paper for a number of reasons. Number one, it isn't often that one finds quotes from Freud's project. Freud's project is usually mentioned as a piece of history, perhaps irrelevant history, but you bring it forward. And specific action, like you say, is common sense. It's when a child cries and the attendant adult responds with attention and help. So simple, and yet so meaningful, because we know so many people, children and adults, who grew up without a dependable specific action in their emotional repertoire. And you tie that up with the child's experience of people responding to their to their internet focus, to their over-involvement in the internet?
I don't know if I grasped the core questions, Harvey, but this aspect in Freud results so interesting also because he put in light another aspect that maybe is relating to what we are asking now. That is that the importance of what we call a specific action is at stake also when we ask ourselves, what does it happen when an action seems specific, but is not? Because this is the case.
Say it once again, when an action what?
When an action seems specific, but is not.
An action seems specific, but is not.
But is not, because this is the case of children exposed to the images, and especially to pornographic ones in the internet. There is a very short passage just in the last page of the project in which Freud suggests that this is the case of those images which he calls motor images, that are perception that as such, of course, arouse some sensoriality, but which, however, has a quality that is no doubt monotonous. And this is the point, because having to do with motor images that are able to arouse excitations but are without a real object, off of a relationship, no? And they end up making a monotony of the subject's investment, and I would like to say both those in the self and those in the object. This is another important aspect, I think, because putting the accent both on the self and to the object,
right,
is quite something specific at stake in trying to understand this area, because without an object, the images the child deals with tend to become indefinitely substitutable. And this is a condition that can favor addiction for children, right, and maybe not only, not only for children.
Let me work us to that point. Let me read a piece that you both wrote very much on this issue of the parental involvement. You write, quote, "The more important theme is the child's need to be able to rely on an adult who is adequately present, an adult of whom questions can be asked, explanations obtained, and with whom there can be a real exchange, avoiding detachment, withdrawal, or dissociation. In this case, it's not just the content of the images or the excessive solicitations that these can put on the child that constitute trauma, but also the lack of contact with an object, a lack that renders impossible the working through of these solicitations." Close quote. A key concept that you introduce here is that the trauma isn't in the overstimulation, which is the way it's commonly spoken of with adults, but for the child, the trauma is in the lack of contact with an object, which is what I take to be fundamental to your thinking.
Yes, it is. It is fundamental because, you know, it's weird. You are right. We, in this paper, we find ourselves facing some very old Freud writings, but it happened to us to find them very interesting because of the attention to sensoriality. And also, for instance, in our work, we we went in touch with the Freudian theorization of trauma as infantile seduction and trauma as the breaking of the protective shield. But we found very, very interesting the concept of trauma developed by Ferenczi and Balint. And we found very useful in our work the Balint concept of trauma. As you said, it's not the actual thing or what happened, what happens that make a trauma such a dangerous experience, but is the fact that the boy turn to the adult to ask for explanations and find no answers or a silence that make him not able to understand, and a traumatic dimension open up in its mind. You know, it's something that reminds, for instance, Winnicott when he say that it's not so important that children don't suffer and have tears, but the important thing is that they can rely in an adult. They can that can help them to recover from those tears, and in this way, sorting out together from a very suffering situation.
And you take that further, and you introduce the notion of suspended investment. And let me read what you write about that. You both say, quote, without an objectual, meaning an objectual quality, an object, that exists outside the images, the subject who uses online pornography runs the risk of investing a great deal of time and interest, but actually tends to achieve a disinvestment, or more precisely, the result can be a suspended investment, both in the object and in the self. In our opinion, then, modern-day online use can bring about the suspension of an investment that, without adequate participation of the object, will end up diluting the subject's instinctual quality. Close quote. It's a very important point.
It's one of the core points of our discourse, of what we have found trying to thinking and thinking together about this this topic and face it to some aspects we met in our clinical practice. And we are much interested in this aspect because it relates to the possibility both to reflect about relationship, but also about the instinctual aspects, the inner instinctual aspects of the child and of the subject who has to do with this situation. No? And as you remind with this quotation, in general terms, we are saying that that is so, always so important that a child may be able to rely on an adult, on a fellow human being, already say Freud, always in the project. But this is a very interesting point, and maybe a key point, because it's also a first early thought of what Freud will take back in account very particularly in the 20s, when he understands how the problem of pleasure is not just an issue of the individual, and it calls in a problem which, very interestingly for us, André Green called through in a very short passage, the problem of the pleasure of the object, of the other. And maybe it's interesting to say something about this topic, because the first aspect is that the exposure to pornography online may provoke a kind of investment which maintains the ego on this side of any real suffering, but also it maintains the subject on this side of any real satisfaction. In fact, these situations may appear in a descriptive perspective, just hedonistic, but on a closer analysis, they prove to be, if anything, unhedonic, something where the true pleasure, maybe there isn't. And maybe we can try to explain this aspect, because a satisfaction can be achieved when the subject can count on a sufficiently authentic exchange with the other and with a real contact between the subject and his object. And this is the topic, the issue of the quality of this exchange, the quality of this contact between the self and the other, between the child and the adult and the caregiver and so on. And one of these of the points we have worked about is how the subject who uses online pornography runs the risk of investing a great deal of time and interest, but actually tends to achieve a disinvestment, or maybe, more precisely, a sort of suspended investment. And this also may be something of interesting for its applicative value. Because let's think, for instance, to the problem of time. No? In the addiction without substances, like Fennekel in the 40s defined this kind of addictions, it's very frequent that someone, that the subject, may expend an amount of time, in our case, staying on the internet with pornographic images and so on. And this is a dilution of perception of time. And I mean that if I'm able, as it were, not to feel time passing, and if I'm able, as it were, again, to suspend my feeling of psychic pain, but also actual feeling of pleasure, I find myself in a sort of dissociation where it...
I was just going to ask you, is what you're describing commonly known as dissociation?
Yeah, we could say that this is a mixed up between what we could call a polarization and a dissociation. Uh-huh. In the sense that I can spend 10, 20 hours of my life, but without I'm able realizing it at all, actually, because I'm not in relationship with my same perception, that are completely suspended in that practice, no? And so this is the more applicative value about what you was asking us, that is to how it's important for the child exposed to online pornographic images not to be left alone.
Not to be left alone. But as you make clear, and I'm about to read, it isn't any caregiver that will suffice to enliven, if you will, an otherwise dissociated child. You write, quote, "In order for the child to find an adult sufficiently present, it is necessary for the adult, the caregiver, to be able to recognize the importance of his presence for the child, the value of their mutual contact, so that they can together confront difficult questions and dilemmas," close quote. So you make clear it is not just a physical being that's required in order to move the child out of this dissociated narcissistic state into an object-related state, but it needs to be a parent who understands, the parent, the caregiver, who understands that he or she is playing an important part in this moment in time in this child's life. And that requires, again, an emotional maturity on the part of the parent. It also requires the parent, to him or herself, not to be on the phone, not to be on a screen. And you make this point, and I think we all hear it clinically. I have patients with young children who tell me repeatedly that their children say to them, "Mommy, Daddy, put the phone down." These are the children telling the parents, "Put the phone down." So obviously there's something missing in that moment that the child is expressing a need for, and it is the parent that is, if you will, we can loosely use the word dissociation, when people are switched out on their phones. But Franco, you have three models, three categories of parental involvement. Why don't you outline, because it really begins to prescribe a course of action for parents, how to deal with this.
Yes, unfortunately, those are not mine, but they come from social research. These three categories that I found very useful come from the research of Alexander Samuel. You can find this data on the internet. Mm-hmm. And Alexander Samuel, in a research that involved more than 10,000 American parents, she, with her study, categorized American under 18 that belong to one of three groups, based on the way that their parents support the use of electronic device. She called them, they were one-third, one-third, one-third equipotential. And she called them digital orphans, digital exiles, and digital heirs. First of these, digital orphans, are allowed to access the internet without bothering their parents at all, as that is, they have unlimited access and are given no guidance. Even in the so-called normal situation, I think the one you were referring to, the use of internet device is often viewed as an educational aid, let's say, to keep the kids busy, as mm-hmm, you mentioned sure. before, without any request for parental interaction. Digital exile, by contrast, are permitted little or no internet access by their parents, who wish to protect them from the possible danger of internet use. And, you know, but we don't want to say that internet is the devil. Internet access is very important in the adolescent search for autonomy.
Let me just emphasize that point you made, because it distinguishes your thoughtfulness from other more casual perspectives. You are not saying that the internet is the devil, is something to be avoided. You're saying that under proper circumstances, it can add a great deal to people's lives under certain circumstances. And that's your category of digital heirs.
Yes, because because internet is impossible to live without internet, and it's important to make a good use of it, as digital heirs do. So, because they are encouraged by parents and teachers to acquire skills and having discussion about their use, and also about possible risks. And it's a topic that can be discussed and can give origin to a good relationship. But we have another research that it's very important on this issue. It is a survey commissioned by AVG, a software firm. And they interviewed more than 6,000 American parents and their children. The children were ages 8 to 13. And they wanted to identify both the perception and the realities of the parents' use of technology devices, but also the opinion of the children. And it's important to know that about one third of the children said that their parents spent equal or less time with them than in using their devices. Over half of the children felt that their parents checked their devices too often and complained that their parents allowed themselves to be distracted by their devices during conversation, something that made a third of them feel unimportant. It must be said that many parents, too, when asked about their devices' usage, agreed that it was too frequent. And many parents also worried about how this looked to the young generation. I conclude by saying that almost a third felt that they did not set a good example for their children with their internet devices. And so we as adults realize that we are not very, very good example for our children. But the problem is how to transform this in something that can be discussed with them and can help to grow up together, grown up together.
You know, I read a shortcut. This was an article written by one of the designers of, I think it was the Apple phone. And he described how they designed the phone to be so captivating. We might say addicting, but nevertheless, just captivating of one's attention. And he said what he has done in his family is very simple and very effective. He takes the color out of the front of the camera. That is, he makes it black and white. And they showed pictures. When you saw the phone with black and white, it didn't have the magical attraction. So much so that when I saw it, I noticed how effective it was. And I didn't do it on my own phone because I liked the stimulation of the bright colors. But it is something that we could think of for children. That is that they can only use the phone, but in black and white mode. And I don't know if there's been a study to compare how much time they devote to it in black and white mode, but perhaps someone listening to this will do that study and report back to us. Franco, you have some clinical material for us, yes?
Yes, I can describe a case where the parents came to me because their son, Vincent, I will call him Vincent, 8-year-old, who had a brother 3 years younger. He was a boy that liked a female classmate very much. And he showed a great interest in the female body. The parents, having installed some application for children on their mobile phone, let him play freely with this device one evening when they were dining out. This is interesting because at 8 years old, being particularly skilled in using the phone, Vincent, following his interest for the female body, went on the internet and did a good search for men who touch women breasts. After a few days, his parents noticed Vincent was strangely silent and seemed absorbed into something. The child asked his mother if it was possible for women to have a penis, and then told her that for the previous few days, he had repeatedly been on the internet and found himself in front of a deluge of images showing every imaginable kind of sexual intercourse. A chronological access history revealed various films with scenes of sexual relations between heterosexual, transsexual couples and groups. And in this treatment, I work with the parents, not with the boy, because it seemed that it was important to help the parents and to cope with the situation, because Vincent was a boy with an intense sexual curiosity, and at 8 years, surely we are in the latency period, and what happens nowadays is something that Florence Guignard in her chapter in a book edited by Alessandra Lemma and Luigi Capparotta, development in the technoculture age. Florence Guignard said that nowadays we have an erosion of latency. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because the continuous stimulation of sensoriality and the lack of, let's say, limit of the lack of something that counterbalance these stimulations, let the children arrive to pre-adolescence without having passed these phases that was latency.
With an impact on symbol formation as well. The importance of latency to develop symbol formation. Yes.
The important thing is the sublimation of the sexual. And if you have actual movement you can do, or if you can bypass what brings you to symbol formation and sublimation, you have to deal with sensoriality. And I think that a lot of attention problems today are linked to this topic. So Vincent Parents talked to him about his curiosity, and without telling him off too much, but they put some limits, not allowing him to go into the internet without permission, and threatening him with a punishment if he disobeyed. The purpose of punishment, I agreed with them, was not to punish actually, but to put a limit that can also restore an order and remove in the boy the guilt and the confusion about what he had done.
It's an important point you're mentioning that deserves to be underlined. The purpose of the punishment wasn't to cause pain, it was to restore order. And order, generational order, is very comforting to individuals, and it relieves their guilt and has them feel safe. And that's an important perspective that's often lost when people consider the role and importance of punishment.
Yes, of course, because thinking what Andrea told us before, it's the importance of the adult is also to confront with the children and take his or her responsibility, even saying no, even forbidding something, only to let the boy transgress it. But, you know, now we live in a period where every parent would like to live with their children without issues, saying always yes, yes. But the limit is important, much more important than we think, because what we remember, for instance, of our parents often is when they confronted us on something, and they let us free eventually to do the same thing, but knowing that we were doing something on our own, not as it comes. That not everything was allowed. So, for instance, in this little case that I saw the mother overall for more or less 1 year, was rather successfully, because what was about the pornography later moved on the use of the place on the internet. And for instance, the boy wanted to play at the beginning Fortnite, who it's a play that I think it's for children more than 12, and he was 9 years, and the parents said no. But that was a generational confrontation that was, let's say, healthy. And I think that when I left the parents, they were the problem of confusion and the difficult state of mind of the child was overcome, and they were involved in a normal confrontation with a little boy who was growing up. And that I think that this letting the river going on the riverbed of development is one of the object of any treatment, I think.
So your work with the parents helped them establish that generational line that facilitated development's progression.
That's something on which I would like to add something, if I can, yes. Harvey, because this is another so interesting aspect of which actually some authors has already speak very well, like Lance Dodds, talking about the importance that therapists and analysts recognize the value that themselves may have in this kind of work, no? To help adults in recognizing in turn their value for children, the value of their being in contact with children. What we were saying before about the limits that is so important and natural for one side is not too, so granted, no, in the everyday practice and situations, and at the same time is very strongly articulated with the problem to find sometimes the space for the child to feel there is the possibility to think about his own feeling with the adults. But this calls on the problem of, as you also anticipated before, the problem of internal resources of adults and how they are available for themselves. An Italian analyst said once many years ago that sometimes when we as adults are in touch with children, are so solicited in our inner world that some parts of us tend to remain secret and hidden and not always available. This is an important point too. And maybe I can, if you want, but I don't know how, just make some short consideration starting from another case we have presented in the paper, after that of Vincent, of whom...
Sure, take a moment, sure.
Yes, and I'm referring to a young boy of 9 years old who lives with his family and two older brothers who had a large use of smartphones and PlayStations and so on. No? And he was supervised by a scholastic tutor due to some very important behavioral problems because he alternate moment of strong aggressivity and, what can I say, excitation or mixed states and so on in the school and the relationship with the classmates and especially with girls, which were very difficult. And the problem was that besides some familiar vicissitude, this so young boy has a very little access to the brother's smartphones and games and videos full of pornographic and often violent situations. That wasn't, of course, the only cause, but the interesting aspect for us is to say something about the important work that the tutor was able to do with this boy, because the tutor was in analysis and was very passionate with the attempt to understanding something of that situation of this boy, who probably was so involving for her also for personal reasons. No? And this gradually made her able to understand something also of the complex effects that inner aspects of this boy, of Richard, the name of the boy, was able to diffract in dynamics into the school, in the relationship with classmates, with teachers, and so on. And what happened? It happened that at a certain point, this tutor, with a good hunch, invented a little space for Richard of 15 minutes where he could go to the gym and play whatever he wanted with her for those few minutes, which was an invention which was very difficult to be accepted by the school, but proved valuable and led to some first progress. And that was so important because starting from then, family started back to see some good effects and to trust a little bit more maybe in the school and in the tutor, and then even in themselves, so that they became closer to the child and realized that there was that big problem of overexposition, but which was continuously to the internet, to the images, to violent images, and so on. And it happened also, but probably not by just by chance, that a, how can I say, a video game shop employee spent time to explain them that games and videos on smartphones could be so problematic if without a space where it was possible to share something about them and so on. And this started up some first little possible transformation. And I think it started, we could say, from the possibility that the tutor, one of the caregivers of this little boy, is able to find a space for herself. No, that's a problem also of which Dodds talked. The importance of the self-value of adults, of caregivers, and in this way also about talking about us, like analysts and therapists, because addictions are so usually full of biological effects that are tend to considered in that way, a drugs problem and so on, but they are so full, on the contrary, of this aspect that are about relationship and so on.
Your point is a good one, and it emphasizes your use throughout the paper of the term caregiver as opposed to parent, because in what's needed is an elder, doesn't have to be an old person, but an elder to the child who can, as we've been talking about, offer some maturity, some thoughtfulness, some space to think, some rules, again, not to inflict pain, but to define generations and to create the space for thinking and symbolization. Let me close with something you've written in your conclusion to your paper. And one of the things I appreciate so much about your thinking is your optimism. One could be very easily pessimistic about the growth of the internet and digital life and artificial intelligence, but you both resist that, and you say the following, quote, "There is no point in criminalizing the new technologies or in emphasizing the negative influence they can have on human thought. We should instead ask ourselves about the intrapsychic and intersubjective aspects at stake in internet usage, taking particular note of the relationship between parents and children, and especially of the relationship's meaning and importance. From this perspective, we can view technological experiences as an opportunity to elaborate and construct shared meanings." Close quote. And that's your message. That's your message to me who read the paper numbers of times. I think that's the message to the listeners, that don't back off oneself, especially don't back off into one's own computers and cell phones. Stay available to children and help them learn to engage by yourself engaging with them. And I want to thank you both. It's a beautifully written paper. I recommend it. It will be obviously in the notes. And I want to thank you for your work with children and the clarity with which you've written these thoughts down and shared it with us. And I look forward to your next project.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, Harvey.
We hope you see you soon. Thank you. Thank you, Harvey. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.